The Laskers are the most coveted and prestigious awards for achievement in biomedical research, often called America's Nobel. Joining me now are three of this year's winners. Ralph M. Steinman, who received the Lasker Award for Basic Medical Research for his discovery of dendritic cells, which could result in revolutionary treatments for cancer and AIDS. Albert Starr, who's being honored with the Lasker Award for Clinical Medical Research for the development of the mechanical heart valve, which has prolonged the lives of millions of people. And Anthony S. Fauci, recipient of the Lasker Award for Public Service. He's played a key role in designing the U.S. governmental programs aimed at HIV/AIDS and bioterrorism. The awards will be given to these great scientists tomorrow, and I'm pleased to be able to honor them today. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Ralph Steinman, what was the accepted theory before your work of how the body's immune system recognized invading germs?
Well, before we began, it was really a mystery how the immune response was initiated, and that was the problem I set out to understand. So we knew the immune system could recognize an infection, but how did it get that information?
Were you the first person ever to observe a dendritic cell?
I guess I was, but in fact, the same cells were seen over 100 years earlier by a German medical student named Paul Langerhans. He saw them in the skin. He thought they were part of the nervous system. And we later returned to those same cells and showed they were really related to the immune system.
So we knew they were there, but we didn't know what they were really doing.
Yeah.
What does a dendritic cell look like?
So the term dendritic means tree-like. And what struck us and what caught our attention was that these cells had very irregular shapes, particularly when you looked at them in the living state. They constantly sent out these processes and retracted them. And we had never seen a cell that looked like that or behaved like that, so we called it a dendritic cell.
And it was those limbs are out there searching for strange things in the body?
Yeah, they're searching for two things. One is they're searching for the infections to pick it up and take it to the immune system. And then once they get to the immune organs, our lymph glands, our spleen, then they have to find the immune cells that are supposed to interact to the information they're carrying. So the name really does seem very appropriate. They're constantly probing and presenting.
Albert Starr, you're a co-winner with Alain Carpentier for the development of mechanical heart valves, which provided for the first time a treatment for people with serious valve disease. You were working separately on different approaches,
trying to
solve the same problem?
Yes, we were working separately. At first, there were no heart valves at all, no way of replacing a valve. And so the first attempts were development of mechanical valves. The first implant was done in 1960. And then Carpentier became interested in tissue valves instead of mechanical valves in the late 1960s and developed a method of preservation of pig valves that allowed them to be used as human implants. And so creating another entire field in valve replacement.
Well, both are being used today.
Yes.
Are there certain people who are the mechanical valves are better for and others where the pig valve is a better choice?
Yes, there's some differences. The mechanical valves will last indefinitely. For example, some of our valves are still working 45 years later. And when we have a chance to look at them, they look exactly the same as when they were put in. The lubricity of blood keeps them from having any wear and tear.
How did you even come up with the idea?
Well, it was an absolutely essential need. And so the need drove the idea. And we tried many different mechanical valves in animals and found that only a ball valve type of prosthesis would allow long-term survival in animals. And so we were able to go from animal to man on the basis of that finding.
Is it true that the ball valve idea came to you when you saw a ball in a bottle of soda pop?
No, we never. I didn't see that until afterwards. I didn't know it had been patented.
Anthony Fauci, though you're a scientist, your award is for your public service because of the two governmental programs that they are awarding you for? You've probably done six or seven different programs over the years.
Well, the ones that are being pointed out are the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, what's referred to as PEPFAR, and that really related based on the work that I had done as a basic scientist and a clinician and running an institute that's responsible for AIDS research, was to appreciate and try and figure out how we can bring the modern day advances that we scientists had made, particularly with the development of drugs for HIV, how we could get that beyond the developed world and make them accessible to the developing world. And many people thought that was impossible. When the prices of the drugs came down and generics were used, I went to Africa on a few trips and really scoped out the situation to see if we can, in fact, use some community care type models to get the drugs to these individuals. So I was tasked to put together a program, and what I did is put together a program which turned out to be a 5-year, $15 billion program to treat 2 million people and prevent 7 million infections. And it's operational, and it's working. So,
well, we've known about AIDS for a long time now, I guess at least 25 years, but the African programs really didn't become effective until 10 years ago at best.
Right. And there was reasons for that, some of which were myths, that things that we couldn't do. And I think probably one of the important aspects of the program was that it showed that if you use certain models, such as the going into the community and the delivery of care and medicine to patients the way Paul Farmer and his associates had done in Haiti, we used that kind of a model and we scoped it out and presented it, and now it is up and running.
Now, you've been doing this over the course of a number of different administrations. Right. Does it matter, or does it get easier under certain political administrations rather than others?
Well, with regard to HIV/AIDS, it's very interesting, except for what everyone feels to be a slow start during the Reagan administration of not only the administration, but, you know, the general public not fully appreciating how serious HIV was and would be. After that, really, all the presidents and congresses that I've dealt with, and I'm very, very, I feel very, very grateful to them, from George H.W. Bush to President Clinton to the current George W. Bush, have been extremely supportive of this. And we've had bipartisan support in the Congress. So it was not a Democrat or Republican thing. It was a United States of America approach, which we should feel very proud of.
I'm speaking to three Lasker Award winners, Ralph M. Steinman, Albert Starr, and Anthony S. Fauci. They will be given the awards tomorrow, I guess, at a gala lunch.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's get back to these things in a little more detail. Ralph Steinman, so you found these dendritic cells, and then you had to figure out what they actually did. They have a really complicated job, don't they?
Yeah, and it's becoming more and more impressive how many things they're involved in. But initially, what we wanted to figure out was how you get immune cells to start to grow, because that's one of the beautiful features of the immune system. You have individual cells that can react to many of the different infections. Each one can see a single infection or a single part of the microbe.
And they have to recognize whether it's a benign cell or whether this is a dangerous cell.
You bet. And so they need the specificity. They need to specifically recognize what's entering the body. And then they have to make the appropriate response. So what we first found was that the dendritic cell could initiate the growth of lymphocytes. And that was a key process, because by having more cells, you could better attack the foreign agent.
Where are the dendritic cells created? In the bone marrow?
They're made in the bone marrow. They're a white blood cell, and all the white blood cells originate there. And then they populate our tissues. For example, they're in our skin. They line our airways. They line our intestines, in a perfect position to pick up infections when they cross the barrier. And then they have this capacity that's quite unique to move from a tissue like the airway or the intestine to the immune organs. And then in those immune organs, they then get access to the cells that have to carry out the response.
How many things can they go after? I'm sure they go after bacteria and viruses, but what about cancer cells? Because I've been hearing about the application of dendritic cells to fighting cancer, but it doesn't seem to have worked yet.
So they have many mechanisms to take up things from their environment, not just infections, but as you mentioned, they can take up cancer cells, they can take up allergens, they can take up our own tissues and even start what's called an autoimmune process. And one of the new areas of dendritic cell biology is to identify the molecular mechanisms that allow them to take things up.
The dendritic cells stimulate T cells. And we've heard a lot about T cells in AIDS research.
So the T cells are a very important part of our immune system. And it's true, the best characterized role for dendritic cells is to stimulate the T cells. But I think what's impressive is that T cells aren't just one entity. They can develop along several lines. A T cell can develop so that it fights an infection. It can develop so that it causes allergy. And the T cell has to get information to know how to develop. And it gets that from the dendritic cell and from the environment in which it finds itself.
Now, there had been a lot of research before attempts to come up with immune responses in culture dishes, and nobody was able to do it. Was it the discovery of the dendritic cells that allowed for this change?
I think that was one of
doing
the
it
important
in culture
consequences.
Dishes too?
We did it first in tissue culture dishes, and that was what was really impressive, that by delivering the immune stimulus, which we call antigen or an infection, we could initiate immunity and get a good response. But as soon as we had that, we went back into the animal and eventually into people to use dendritic cells to initiate immunity. And I think that's a field that's really poised to develop much more vigorously, particularly, as you mentioned, to deliver cancer cells or cancer antigens on the dendritic cells.
Is this as promising as stem cell research is said to be?
It's a different kind of research, but yes, I feel it has promise to deal with several medical conditions. And in case of cancer, we really lack other therapies in many cases, and the immune arm is something that really should be tapped.
How has the field of immunology changed since your discovery?
I think what's impressive is how much it's grown, how much more we appreciate that the immune system does and the mechanisms that are required to bring it about. So I mentioned, for example, that T cells can make many kinds of immune responses. And even this year, there was a brand new type of T cell, which is called Th17, discovered, which makes a particular type of immune response that's probably very important in certain infections and also causes some diseases when it goes awry. So we're always learning new things that the immune system does, and we're bringing that to bear upon medical conditions.
Albert Starr,
yes.
you developed your mechanical heart valves with the engineer Lowell Edwards. How did the two of you go about coming up with a design for the valve, this free floating ball inside a cage?
Well, Edwards came to see me in the early days of open heart surgery in the late 1950s, and actually 1958, and he wanted to develop an artificial heart. He was a engineer, very interested in fluid dynamics, and I told him we didn't even have heart valves, let alone an artificial heart. So why don't we work together on this project, but start one valve at a time? And at that time, it looked like the mitral valve might be the most difficult one to do. And so we thought we'd start out with the mitral valve.
Because if you could get that one, then the other ones would be a lot easier.
The other ones would fall into place. He was retired at the time and had his own little laboratory in a shack on the Sandy River in Oregon, and was able to supply prototypes very rapidly for animal implantation. So we tried many different types of leaflet valves, and they all thrombosed within about 1 or 2 days after implantation. So we were stymied and eventually used the ball valve design, which allowed long-term survival in animals.
The first artificial valves were implanted into dogs. How do you move from using them in dogs to using them in people?
Yeah, that was a big issue. And my own personal feeling at the time was we needed more animal experimentation. But we had a kennel full of very happy dogs, having had mitral valve replacement. And the chief of cardiology came in to see them one afternoon and said, "You know, Al, you've got to use this device in people because I've got a hospital full of patients in oxygen tents who are dying."
And what happens when you go to people and say, "Look, we want to try something with you that has never been tried before, except on dogs.
Well, they were very appreciative. I mean, there was no such thing at that time of informed consent. There were also no clinical trials defined by the FDA. FDA was not involved in artificial valves, only in drugs.
So they didn't regulate medical devices?
No, there was no regulation. We had to figure everything out ourselves. We developed an informed consent. We separated the financial aspects from the biologic aspects, from the medical aspects. Looked at other important elements in going from animal to man, and finally we made the decision to go ahead.
And then you had to track the clinical trials of the valve.
Right.
Did you know what you were getting yourself into?
Yes, we did, and because what we decided was two things with regard to patients. One, we would track them for the rest of their lives, and that was an obligation that we would have.
Well, how many people have them now? You must be tracking thousands and thousands
we
of
are.
People.
We are, yeah. We're tracking ourselves from our own patients, at least 10,000 patients. And the other thing was we had to organize clinical trials at other centers. And so we did that. And we went to major centers in the United States and Europe. We taught them how to do the operation. And then the obligation was that they would have to give us any adverse information, any information about their patients.
So you're involved in the creation of the cardiac intensive care unit, in effect.
Yes. At that time, there was no cardiac intensive care unit. There were no CCUs, for example. And so we converted a post-anesthesia room to an intensive care unit.
And that now this is one of the those medical procedures that I'm sure many doctors are capable of doing.
Oh, yes. There are many hundreds of thousands of valves implanted every year throughout the world.
And what has been the success rate? There must be a few that don't work.
Well, the success rate as far as the valves themselves are very high. Degeneration of a mechanical valve, the failure to function of a mechanical valve is very unusual. Now, tissue valves are a little different, and there the tissue valves do tend to wear out with time. But the current valves will last about 10 to 15 years, which is good for elderly patients.
The tissue valves are more likely to be put into older or younger patients?
Yes, they'd be more likely to put into older patients, except for an occasional younger patient who does not want to take anticoagulant medication because maybe of their occupation or the sports they engage in. And so they would rather have a reoperation later and be free of any medication while they have the valve.
My guests are three of the Lasker Award winners. How many Lasker Award winners altogether?
Four.
Four. Oh, so the only other one is Alan Carpentier. They are Ralph Steinman, Albert Starr, and Anthony Fauci. And we will be back with Anthony Fauci after we take a little break. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Stay with us. We're back with three of the four Lasker Award winners this year. Anthony Fauci, recipient of the Lasker Award for Public Service. Albert Starr, who has won the Lasker Award for Clinical Medical Research. And Ralph Steinman, who is the Lasker Award winner for Basic Medical Research. And it occurs to me that there is another award that should be given this year, and that's to Brooklyn, because two of you are from Brooklyn.
That's
true, right.
Albert Starr and Anthony Fauci.
And I was a Dodger fan growing up in Montreal.
Okay, well, that's because the Dodgers farm team was the Montreal Royals.
Exactly.
There's no connection between Brooklyn and what you've achieved, is there?
Well, I went to a really great high school in Brooklyn, and they prepared me for academic work, James mm-hmm. Madison High School.
Right. What school did you go to?
I went to Regis High School right here in Manhattan. Even though I lived in Brooklyn, I used to take the BMT line from home in Brooklyn in the Bensonhurst section to Manhattan.
Anthony Fauci, tell me about Project BioShield, your public health program designed to protect Americans from bioterrorism.
Right. We had been working prior to 9/11 and the anthrax attacks on the basis of knowing that they were countries that were making bioweapons. This is very clear that was going on, and that's no secret. It was a very, very small program. After 9/11 and the anthrax attack, we mounted up a very strong biodefense effort, where we bring the forces of basic biomedical research to try and develop countermeasures like vaccines, diagnostics, and therapeutics for microbes that we know could be threats, and that range from smallpox through anthrax, botulism, Ebola, et cetera.
Well, since all of these things are rare,
right,
doctors have to recognize from the start that this is, you know, they're going to see something that they've never seen before, and they have to know that this is anthrax or this is Ebola.
Right. So there were several things that needed to be done. One was on educating the public health community, the physicians and those who would be responsible for taking care of people. And the other was an important issue that we needed products. We didn't have vaccines against many of these things for obvious good reason. They were never felt to be a threat. So when we put the fundamental basic research into it, because of a lot of resources that were given to do that, we found that there was a problem. The problem is we could not get incentives for pharmaceutical companies to perform the very important component that they do when products are made like vaccines and drugs. So we could do all the research we wanted, but we couldn't get buy-in for the companies because they felt it was too risky for them to get involved. So what I helped to do was to try and make the link between the basic research that we were doing in my institution with how we get a pathway to the product. And the pathway was to get a financial incentive, to have set aside money in legislation authorized by the Congress to be able to buy and pay for these countermeasures when they were developed, even if we never used them. Because the way the system goes now, you only get paid for what you use. So we were saying to the companies, you get involved with us to help us make a vaccine against Ebola or anthrax or what have you, and we'll guarantee you, even if we never get an attack, we'll buy it. And that was the legislation, which was called Project BioShield.
Now, the institution you're talking about is the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases,
correct,
isn't it? And you're involved in a lot more than bioterrorism.
Right.
You're the people who are involved with worrying about flu, and avian flu, and HIV/AIDS.
And malaria and tuberculosis and those killers in the developing world.
So you have to combine regular research into things that are more common.
Precisely. In fact, that was the whole underlying strategy of what we did in the biodefense arena. And I think to the wisdom and help of the Congress and the administration, we made a point that nature is essentially the worst bioterrorist. We've learned over the years that when you look at things like smallpox, the pandemic flu of 1918, polio, so nature can be a bioterrorist. So we're going to get emerging and re-emerging infections. So we might as well, when we do research, to be able to get the capital, be it intellectual or physical infrastructure, that would be able to help us against a naturally occurring microbe in addition to a deliberately emerged microbe.
Now, researchers will have told me in the past that politics is always an issue in their field, often politics within the field. In your case, you also have to worry about the other kind of politics because you're dealing with the White House and with Congress.
Right. Well, the best way to get through those sometimes difficult waters, as it were, to wade your way through is, and I've tried that, and I think it's been successful, is to always speak the scientific truth and let what you tell people be based on fundamental, sound scientific principles. Leave all ideology out of it. It doesn't matter who you're dealing with in the Congress or the administration. They are looking for people who would give them the cold truth. Now, there's a danger in that because when you give the truth, sometimes you're telling people things they don't want to hear. And you've got to be able to say, I'm going to walk away from this arena because I've told the truth. And if they're not accepting it, then that's it. But generally, they do. They generally do accept that.
Although we have heard about politics playing a role in everything from stem cell research to whether there's global warming. So how do you get past that? You know, telling the truth is one thing, but if somebody then starts quoting from his version of the Bible or whatever, don't you run into real problems?
Well, in the arena in which I have been involved, namely HIV/AIDS, the emergence of natural
HIV/AIDS was a perfect example. It became very political initially.
Yeah, indeed it was in the beginning. But when you're talking about protecting the country against the emergence of natural infections or the deliberate emergence, as well as HIV/AIDS, there's very little ideological issues there. So we stem cell, you have people on different sides of the ideology. You have a variety of other things that people argue about politically. There's very little argument that we need to protect the country against emerging infections that are natural as well as biodefense.
In some cases, it isn't American politics you have to worry about. Avian flu became a big issue with Asian countries, right, especially China, that was for a while denying that there even was a problem.
It was very frustrating. One of the real hallmarks of an effective and successful program against the emergence of new microbes is that this is a global issue. It isn't just in the United States, and you have to rely on the transparency and the openness of the nations from which these microbes might first evolve. And we had a terrible trouble early on with China. We had trouble with SARS. When the first cases were recognized, they were not forthcoming about that. And even in some of the earlier situations vis-a-vis the emergence of human infections from the H5N1 bird flu. So that is, as you say correctly, one of the issues we have to get over. So we really need to try and convince these nations that it is for their own benefit, ultimately, for them to be transparent and honest.
You were in the news a lot after the anthrax scare of 2001. You must have been very concerned about not saying the wrong thing.
Well, I think this gets back to speaking the truth. And I think the reason we were successful in communicating to the country is that you have to not be afraid to say what you don't know. When you get up in a public arena and try to guess on things, then you have the public lose confidence in you and lose confidence in your trustworthiness. If you just speak the truth and say, this is what we know, this is what we believe the risk is, and there's a lot that we don't know, the public will buy that.
Isn't there a real problem if somebody wanted to carry out a bioterror attack, that it's hard to deliver all of these things? Should we not feel all that afraid?
I don't think we should be afraid. I think we should be prepared. And I think that's one of the messages that we really need to get across when the general public hears us talking about preparedness. We need to dissociate preparedness, which may be for something that will never happen, from a fear that may be an inappropriate fear. But you're quite correct. It is probably, I can't put a scientific number on it, but it is less likely that we would have something that could be effectively, deliberately released than we would have a naturally occurring infection that could spread throughout the world in a natural way.
Well, we've seen anthrax from the heads of drums,
right.
But something like anthrax is one person at a time.
Exactly.
It would be very difficult to just release a whole bunch of anthrax germs in, or whatever it is. Is it bacteria?
No,
into
it's
the
actually
subway.
The spores of a bacteria, and it's easily deliverable if you have a confined system like a ventilation system in a building. To just let it out in a plane in open air would have very, very little deleterious effect.
Do you still see patients?
I do. I see patients a couple of times a week, every week, all year round.
Because you feel you have to keep your hand in?
Well, yes. I'm fundamentally have the identity of a physician scientist. And an important part of that is being a physician. And I get ideas for things that I want to do in the lab from seeing patients. And it also confirms and fortifies the things that I'm doing in the lab, that it does have an extrapolation to a real person. So seeing the real person and taking care of the real person, it helps round out the whole picture of what you're doing.
My guests are three of the four Lasker Award winners this year, Anthony S. Fauci, Albert Starr, and Ralph M. Steinman, all involved in biomedical research of one sort or another. Albert Starr, you've said that up until now, all of the appreciation you've heard has been from patients. This is the first time you've actually had this kind of recognition from your peers?
No, I had a few, but nothing as prestigious as this. This is a marvelous thing to undergo. And, you know, I've had some college awards and honorary degrees, that kind. Award from the American College of Cardiology, for example.
Well, how important is a Lasker Award? I've received a few awards over the years, and everybody pats me on the back, and then we forget all about it.
Oh, I think it's terrific. Yeah. The last surgeon to receive a Lasker Award was Michael DeBakey, so and that was a long time ago. So I feel that I'm representing those in my field, and it's a great honor to do so.
Awards like this are actually humble you a lot, because if you look at the string of people before you who've gotten those awards, you kind of have to slap yourself to say, do I really belong in this company?
Well, what's interesting is that there is a Lasker Award because there's no Nobel that's comparable. You would have thought that the Nobel Awards would have that they would have come up with a prize for these kinds of
they usually do. Mm-hmm. People who get Laskers
wind up getting Nobels later.
Yeah. Not always, but certainly there's a very interesting tradition about that.
I agree with Albert that the beauty of the Lasker Award is it highlights a field, in our case, my case, immunology and dendritic cell biology, which was really brought about by a lot of scientists working worldwide.
The award also comes with an honorarium of $150,000. Can you just use that money any way you want?
It's an unrestricted, yeah.
That's a nice little added bonus here. So have you already thought about what you're going to do with the money? I'm not going to ask you.
No, I could tell. I have three children who I have to send through college. That's easy.
This takes
That's
care
a
of
no-brainer.
An awful lot of worries that you might have had otherwise.
Well, I'm sharing mine with my friend Carpentier. Mm-hmm. And we have been good friends for many years. And so it would be fun to do that.
Well, in that case, you get along. There are many people in similar situations who wind up becoming rivals, don't they?
No, we're not. We're not.
There are always these people who are saying, I really did it first. No, I did it first. Uh-huh. So mine is better.
No, because we developed the product along two different lines. One was mechanical, and the other was tissue, and one followed the other in a logical sequence.
Carpentier operated on Charlie Rose, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Uh-huh. Plus the King of Belgium and a few other notables.
Well, if I need a heart valve, I'm going to come to you, Albert.
Okay, thank you very much. It will last a long time, too.
Is there any kind of a downside to winning an award of this sort? Does the increase in prestige hamper the collaboration?
I'm not aware of a downside.
Well, that's nice.
No, I don't think there's a downside to it. The only potential downside would be, is this the end? I mean, you ask yourself, is this the end of the line? I mean, what else is there?
Well, the Nobel in literature seems to always be the end,
God,
of, the end of the line
beyond,
for an awful lot of writers.
Yeah, right.
But you'll just keep on doing what you do?
Yes, we'll keep on doing what we're doing.
Are you working to perfect the heart valve, or is it pretty, has it?
Oh, no. We have very active programs going on in further development. One is the percutaneous implantation method, using catheter-based technology to implant these valves without surgery or major surgery. So that's a very important use.
And as we said earlier in talking about dendritic cells, the research is really just beginning.
Yeah, our lab is heavily focused on using this biology to develop better vaccines, both for global infectious diseases and cancers. There's lots to do.
In the case of bioterrorism, a number of vaccines have been developed that people have felt were worse than the problem itself. How do we come up with vaccines that don't cause serious problems for something like anthrax?
Through scientific discovery and development.
Is work being done right now?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the candidates for anthrax vaccine, there are several now that are being in various stages of development for just that point that you make, that some of the vaccines, although they're quite protective, they have either real or perceived toxicities that make people reluctant to take them. So that's one of the important goals in this, is to develop safe and effective countermeasures.
What do you do when people say, I'm just not going to be vaccinated? We've seen that not only with anthrax and other things, but we're seeing a lot more with parents of children who are afraid that vaccines are causing things like autism.
Well, you will never, under any circumstances, essentially coerce anybody or force somebody to have something done to them like a vaccine. What you try and do is you try and educate them as to the scientific basis or lack of scientific basis for their concerns. There are some vaccines that have a bad reputation where people don't realize that if you don't take the vaccine, the ultimate situation that will evolve will be worse than any rare toxicity from a vaccine. But you have to be convincing and have your argument be based on facts and experience, as opposed to having an emotional back and forth about it.
Now, Ralph Steinman, there's never going to be a situation where we get an injection of dendritic cells, right? We have to create our own?
Oh, yes, there will be. In other words, we can now generate dendritic cells in very large numbers outside of the body and then put them back, and that procedure is safe. What we have to learn how to do is how to load them with clinically relevant information, like a tumor cell. And then once we inject them, we have to learn how to get them to behave optimally in the recipient. So I think that's a really good area for research, and we very much need to do this in patients, and not just experimental animals.
My thanks to all three of you. Ralph M. Steinman, winner of the Lasker Award for Basic Medical Research. Albert Starr, winner of the Lasker Award for Clinical Medical Research, and Anthony S. Fauci, who won the Lasker Award for Public Service. It's been fascinating to talk to all three of you, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And I hope this means that you're going to see a flood of new money to do more research. On tomorrow's show, guest host Amy Eddings looks at how residents of Bushwick are responding to the neighborhood's rapid gentrification, and then a documentary about little-known instances of African-American communities being banished from southern counties between the Civil War and World War II. Plus, Please Explain is all about how currencies are valued and why American and Canadian dollars are now at the same rate. Also, Ang Lee with his new movie, Lust Caution. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Rory Bernstein, Tanya Wiedeking, Scott Goldberg, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Tune in tomorrow.